There's a special touch to an English country garden.
A certain amount of disorganisation, a riot of colour, throwing all sorts of plants together that normally you wouldn't associate with each other. And it gives that very sort of almost wildness about it.
Coming up, a guide to the inspiring gardens of Britain. A search for quiet places, indoors and out in a big city like Paris.
Beautiful community gardens, which are exquisitely full of box trees and lavender, and they're really exquisite places to sit and talk to your friends.
And we examine how, more than 50 years later, the Wilderness Act has helped protect natural places that offer life-changing experiences for young and old alike.
Without saying anything, without explaining anything, a child simply gets what a significant and beautiful and enchanted world he or she is a part of. And that's something that they can take with them for the rest of their lives and often do.
Celebrate Earth Day with us in the hour ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. Back in 1964, Congress was nearly unanimous when it passed the Wilderness Act. Since then, more than 100 million acres of federal land in the U.S. have been protected from development. Coming up, naturalist Gary Ferguson looks at what more than 50 years of federal statute have done to cultivate a relationship between Americans and our land. On the other hand, the noise of big cities, even beautiful ones like Paris, can wear you out. In the hour ahead, we'll hear about one woman's quest for the quieter places that you can enjoy next time you're in London, Paris, New York, or Amsterdam. We're at 877-333-7425. Let's start today's Travel with Rick Steves imagining ourselves in a fragrant riot of color with our friends from England, Tom Hooper, Roy Nichols, and Gillian Chadwick. They'll help us appreciate a classic English country garden.
In an English country garden.
La 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 la. La 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 la. La 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 la. In an English country garden.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. I've joined by three mere musical guides, and we're talking about English gardens. And English people just break into song at the even mention of an English garden. So Roy Nichols, Gillian Chadwick, Tom Hooper, all musical guides.
Absolutely.
I've never heard you guys sing.
So you can tell.
Musical gardens.
You know, I am not into gardens. If I don't know what the opposite color of a green is, but that's the color
black.
Of my thumb. Black. I've got
black
a
thumb.
Black thumb. But when I'm in Britain, I got to say, I'm really blown away by the gardens. I enjoy them. Hidcote Manor, Bodnon Gardens.
Because, yeah.
Beautiful gardens. What is it that distinguishes an English garden?
I think it's because so many of the continental gardens are so manicured and so organized.
Yeah.
And at the heart of a true English cottage garden is a certain amount of disorganization.
You mean weeds?
Not weeds. Anyway, weed is just a flower in the wrong place.
Yes.
I think it's that not over-organized, a certain amount of disorganization, a riot of color, not worrying too much about matching colors and everything else like this, throwing all sorts of plants together that normally you wouldn't associate with each other. And it gives that very sort of almost wildness about it. And I think that's at the heart
of
it.
So there's an intentional roughness.
Yes,
definitely.
Yes. So it's not over-manicured, over-organized, yes.
Because when I'm at Beatrix Potter's cottage, it's just a beautiful sort of festival of color, but it doesn't seem very well organized.
That would be very
formal.
Typical of a house garden.
And that's quite deliberate.
Maybe it goes back to the Romantic era when people,
I think it has a much longer history than that. Mm-hmm. One thinks about the 18th and 19th centuries, the Romantic movement and the picturesque movement. But that beginnings of English country gardening go back to medieval times.
Where might we see something like that in our travels?
There's a wonderful, there's the Physic Garden in Chelsea, which is a good example of one of those early herb gardens. There's the Wealden Downland Museum in Sussex, not far outside of Chichester. This is a recreation of or rebuilding of medieval buildings on a particular site. And they have some wonderful recreations of medieval gardens.
It is quite interesting how when centuries roll by, different influences come into the way you design your garden. So the medieval gardens give way to Tudor gardens. And then when you get to the 18th century, there is this idea, we must control nature. So you have great landscape gardeners like Capability Brown, who at places like Blenheim Palace.
Capability Brown, this is the guy's name. Yeah. He's a great landscape architect.
He wasn't christened that.
No.
Sir Lancelot. And he'd arrive and say, I have the capability
to do
Oh, that was his nickname.
Yes. Yes.
So he was a very proud man, proud gardener.
I have the capability to turn your estate into the best view in England.
So they called him Capability Brown. Yes. What are the top two or three names to remember among landscape architects in Britain?
Le Notre,
that would be a Frenchman. Yes. Did he have an impact in England?
He came over to landscape Greenwich.
Because you find his work in the Loire Valley and the chateaus there. Capability Brown.
Gertrude Jekyll. Sissinghurst. Virginia Woolf.
Vita Sackville West. But I think the important thing is it tends to be the polite buildings, the large estates, the large country houses that tend to adopt the continental fashions in gardening, whether it's Italian or French. But it's the English country gardens that remain constant, and that sort of naturalness.
English country gardens. What's a good example of that?
Places like Sissinghurst in Kent.
And if you were just traveling around Britain, everybody's got this typical itinerary. What are three or four gardens that we should be sure to factor in as we're traveling?
Well, one of my favorites is Bodnant in North Wales, just outside the town of Conwy.
So if you're going to North Wales to see all the castles, it isn't English
because it's Wales, but it's one of the great gardens.
Gardens. Yeah. And it's got this manor house where you can sit on the back deck and look out at these gardens. Yeah. And then you can hike down. And I believe there's even sort of a mystical forest you walk, a little valley. And it's just a nice little hike even.
Yeah.
Gorgeous thing. Gillian.
I live in Sussex, and that's very near Kent. So these are the two gardens of England, basically. So there are dozens of beautiful gardens. Nyman's, Leonardsley, Wakehurst Place.
Where is this relative to London?
South of London, about 20, 30 miles.
So within an hour, you could get to some of these gardens from London. This is, of course, not England. It's Ireland. But I was really impressed at Powers Court Garden, if you're going to be in Dublin. Roy, you've had groups in Powers
Court. Yes, south of Dublin, in the Wicklow Mountains, a gorgeous garden. Based around an old ruined 18th century manor house.
A lot of these gardens are based around some historic manor house.
Yeah, I come from Cornwall, which is a milder place than most of the rest of the country, so there are some fantastic gardens down there.
There's just something intoxicating in the air when the gardens of Britain are in bloom. Right now on Travel with Rick Steves, we're getting tips for enjoying scores of formal, wild, and historic gardens that you can tour in the British Isles. Our guides are Tom Hooper from London, Gillian Chadwick, who lives in nearby Sussex, and Roy Nichols. He makes his home in the English countryside of Devon. What about just at Kew Gardens? I mean, that's probably the most famous opportunity.
How could we forget?
Roy, what's Kew Gardens?
It's the main sort of headquarters and gardens of the Royal Horticultural Society.
Botanical
Society.
Uh-huh. And it's got this industrial age iron and glass structure, which is quite striking on
those
its own.
Those great greenhouses of the 19th century, which could be really large and elaborate, it's the ultimate one in Kew.
Oh, and it's like going to the jungle in London.
It is. But all country houses would have had them on a large or small scale, growing exotic things like oranges and pineapples
and that must have been a big deal in the 19th century to grow this sort of thing.
And pineapples are so expensive, you could rent them for the evening and return them the next day.
Rent? Only in Britain can you rent a pineapple. That's pretty good. Now, is it my imagination or does Anne Hathaway's cottage up in Shakespeare's
House?
It's a gorgeous... Yes. That really, I just thought it was like an explosion of color.
Yeah. Mm.
And also a classic English garden because it seemed intentionally messy.
And set against the beautiful outside of the
With the thatches coming down. It was like the thatches are like bangs on a hairdo.
And I think that is the quintessential view of so many people's view of England. That sort of old thatch building, timber framed, with these riotous gardens with all this colour.
Oh, it is nice. Now, something a little more formal would be rose gardens. And in my travels, I've bumped into rose gardens around Britain. Where are some rose gardens you would pick?
Hampton Court. Has got the most glorious gardens.
Don't miss the rose garden there. Yeah. There's a rose garden right in Hyde Park.
In Regent's Park, near Baker Street.
Okay.
And Warwick Castle has got a superb rose garden.
And you miss it. You're making a beeline for the castle, and then there's a little path through the hedge, and you've got this glorious rose garden.
Yeah, it's a super place.
So rose gardens, pay attention to that. And labyrinths.
Labyrinths are quite fashionable now.
Yeah.
Mazes, that's right.
Hampton Court,
maybe the most famous Hampton Court.
Leeds Castle has a very
And there's a very up-and-coming one at Blenheim Palace as well.
Oh, yeah.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking gardens with three people very enthusiastic about English gardens. Give me a little rendition of your favorite tune, please. Roy, Gillian, and Tom.
La, 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 in an English country garden.
This is such an inspiration. I'm going to England. I'm going to roll up my sleeves. I'm going to a garden.
Our phone number is 877-333-7425, and Elise is on the phone from Nevada City in California. Elise, thanks for your call.
Sure, hi.
Hi, do you have a comment or a song for our guides?
A comment. One of the less of a formal garden was Henry Moore's home. What really impressed me was his acreage of this rolling hills and grass, and sitting among these 70 acres are these massive stone and bronze statues. Just, they were absolutely exquisite to just touch them and walk around and be among his work. I believe it's the largest collection.
This is Henry Moore's home, actually.
Yes. Hoglands is the name of his home, which kind of attracted me to the whole idea. Well, go see what Hoglands is.
Where is this from in relation to other places we might go, Roy?
It's in Kent?
Hertfordshire?
Hertfordshire.
So find Henry Moore's home, and you've got a chance to mix the gardens and his beautiful sculpture.
Yes, it was quite impressive.
And Elise, his garden is just littered with these beautiful Henry Moore statues, the minimalist modern statues.
And quite deliberately, Moore placed some of the statues in sheep pastures. Yes. So you get all the sheep wandering around these incredible pieces of artwork.
Nice. Elise, thanks for your call.
Sure, thank you.
Tom Hooper, Gillian Chadwick, and Roy Nichols, thanks so much for getting us a little inspired for English gardens. Just to sum it up, what's one more tip you would give to our listeners who are planning a trip to England and might want to enjoy the gardens to the most? Gillian.
If you can travel in May, it's my favourite time with all the blossoms. Mm-hmm. And if you happen to be in Wales, Bodnant Garden has the most fabulous Laburnum Arch, where you walk about 100 yards and it's like bells of yellow flowers dropping down on you.
Tom Hooper.
If you're in the Lake District and you're interested in Wordsworth, people go to Dove Cottage, but don't forget to go to Rydal Mount, where he spent most of his time.
That was after he had some money and he moved into a fancy manor house. Yeah.
And there are some fantastic gardens there, and it's not far from where he wandered lonely as a cloud and saw the daffodils.
Mm, right.
There's an organisation called the National Garden Scheme, which brings together private gardens and private gardeners. And one or two days a year, usually sort of June time, at the height of the garden season, they open these private gardens. Gardens that are normally closed off to the public. You get the chance, sometimes for a small fee, to see these wonderful gardens.
Gillian, Tom and Roy, thank you so much. And my black thumb has just got a little more appreciation of green.
Thank you, Rick.
Okay, bye now. Being raised on a vicarage in the middle of England, Siobhan Wall was accustomed to the serenity you'd enjoy in an English country garden, especially when your home sits right next to the village church. When she left for the city, she had to find a way to cope with all the turmoil and the noise. We'll learn next about her quiet guides, where you too can find an oasis in the middle of a big, noisy city. And a little later in the hour, we'll look at what it takes to preserve wilderness in America and why designating protected areas is just one part of the endeavor. We're finding pleasure in tranquil places today on Travel with Rick Steves. Support for Travel with Rick Steves comes from Rosetta Stone, believing that an adventurous spirit and some basic language skills make all the difference when connecting with someone from another culture. Offering a method of immersion and speech recognition to help you learn one of 30 languages. Learn more at rosettastone.com/ricksteves. For some, the grandeur of a great city can get drowned out quickly by all the bustle of the traffic and the city noise. Siobhan Wall has found hundreds of the quieter places, indoors and out, where you can catch your breath, get out of the crowds, and hear yourself think in several of my favorite cities. She's authored handy guides to the more quiet environments like parks, cultural centers, and small shops and cafes, where you can relax in London, Paris, Amsterdam, and New York. She's on the line from Amsterdam right now on Travel with Rick Steves, and we'll add your suggestions for quiet places in the city, too, at 877-333-RICK. Siobhan, hello.
Nice to be here.
This is so important when we're tackling big, intense cities that we have a place just to find a little tranquility. Tell us why you wrote a book about quiet places in these great cities.
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. The first thing was I was teaching at a university in London. I was teaching photography and video documentary. And I developed a hearing problem. I've got Meniere's disease, which makes me a bit dizzy. And I couldn't hear, if I went to noisy restaurants, I couldn't hear my friends speak. I couldn't join in the conversation. So I started to look for quiet restaurants. And then I realised that perhaps other people might be interested in these as well. And I grew up in a big vicarage with a beautiful garden next to a church in Leicestershire, which is in the middle of England. And so I was used to being in quiet places, in the churchyard, wandering through the churchyard. And because my father was a vicar, I kind of was very familiar with that kind of side of life, the quiet, more reflective side of life. And I spent a lot of my childhood reading as well.
Just the thought of growing up in a vicarage, in a churchyard in rural England, and then thinking of the cities that you tackled, Paris, London, Amsterdam, and New York, I can see how that contrast is amazing. Now, when you studied Paris, London, Amsterdam, and New York, how are these cities different when it comes to searching for calm? Are some of them easier, or were some of them more frustrating?
Yeah, New York was a lot more frustrating because there are hardly any restaurants that don't play music, background music. I think I only found about three or four. And interestingly, the ones that don't play music are the more traditional places, such as Barney Greengrass, where you can get amazing sturgeon and bagels and whitefish salad. So I was really happy to find that.
You know, why is it that people seem afraid of silence? I go to airports, I go to cafes, I go to restaurants, and they want to fill the air with muzak, even at airports. Have you noticed that at airports?
Yes, and apparently in pubs, if the pub manager plays music, they're much more likely to get people to drink alcohol. People drink more quickly if there's loud music. So it's a commercial decision. But it means that I wouldn't want to stay in a pub that played loud music because I wouldn't be able to have a conversation with my friends. So I'll go to the pubs that don't play music.
I would bet there's financial incentive for airports to be filling the airwaves also with cable news or music.
Well, I think one of the other reasons is that it stops people loitering. And I know that Brussels Underground, the metro, they play classical music because it's just not cool if you're a kind of young teenage hoodie wearer to be seen to be listening to classical music. So that's why they play Bach and Beethoven in the metro in Brussels.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Siobhan Wall, and Siobhan has spent a lot of energy and time looking for quiet places and writing about them in London, Paris, Amsterdam, and New York. Her guidebooks are Quiet New York, Quiet Paris, Quiet Amsterdam, and so on. Siobhan, when you're doing these books, I want to talk about Paris specifically in a minute, but if you're looking in general, even for places you've not written a book about or anything like that, are there some general tips that you find helpful for people that just want a little bit of tranquility in a big city?
I think the best thing to do is to go to a church, first of all, or a place of worship, because the people who go there will want, well, they're sort of looking for quietness usually. Mm-hmm. And the second thing I'd suggest is that you actually talk to somebody in a quiet place, because they invariably know about another quiet place. That's how I did my research.
So you could go to a park and talk to locals who hang out in the park?
Yeah, that happened in Fort Tryon Park in New York. I remember going in this amazing, beautiful park. It's kind of got cliffs, it's got a river beneath, it's got wonderful kind of gardens and hilltops. And I saw this red bird in a tree, and I didn't know what it was because I'm not familiar with American birds. So I asked this couple who were looking at it and talking about it. I said, "What bird is that?" And they said, "Oh, that's a cardinal." And then I told them about the book I was working on, and they told me about quiet restaurants and other quiet gardens. And I find also people who are appreciative of quiet places are often really kind and really helpful. It's as if it attracts a certain kind of person who isn't afraid of strangers, isn't afraid to kind of share their information.
It's funny you say that because London has beautiful parks, and the people I meet in London's parks are peaceful people. They go there for their soul. They're nourishing their soul in the park, and they're gentle people to talk to.
Yes, I agree.
Siobhan, you wrote in the introduction to your Amsterdam book that you have a kind of a not-so-hidden agenda in writing these books. Tell us about what motivates you to write these books.
Well, one of the reasons I wrote it is that I'd been working at a university in London. It was really in the middle of a roundabout, a very busy area on the East End. And I'd gone to the university at Cambridge myself, so I'd been able to sit in nice quiet courtyards and appreciate, yeah, stillness, really. And I couldn't find that in the university where I was teaching. And I thought, where would I like to have lunch, sitting in a park in a garden with other colleagues? And I found some really pretty places, like a churchyard in the East End, which had been bombed during the war, designed by Wren, this beautiful church. And, this has turned into a garden.
You know, London has beautiful gardens with all the Wren churches and the church gardens that really are. They function as an oasis in the middle of a big city. I find it interesting to compare cultures when it comes to noisiness. My hotelier friends in Italy remind me that Italian travelers want the front room with the view and the noise. They like the clamor of the street in their world. And a lot of Americans would rather have quiet and silence at night, so they give up the view and they take the back rooms. Do you find that there is a appetite for quiet and clamor and commotion that changes from culture to culture?
Well, I would say that in America, people who go to restaurants and find there's no music, they find it kind of slightly disturbing. It's like they think, what's wrong? And in London and in Paris, if there's no music in a restaurant, people don't even notice sometimes, and they appreciate it. So that, I noticed, was a big difference.
It's interesting you say that, because when I'm researching my guidebooks for Britain, I've got a lot of friends that run B&Bs, and when I'm sitting there at breakfast and there's no music, all I hear is the clack of the silverware and the awkward silence of people who are sitting together but not talking. And I encourage the B&B host to play music, and they don't always see it the same way. So maybe that is a cultural thing. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Siobhan Wall, and she has a series of books for people that would like a little tranquility in their big city travels. She's got books called Quiet New York, Paris, London, and Amsterdam. Siobhan, let's talk about Paris. You know, Paris is intense. It can be stressful. There's sirens, metro lines, aggressive traffic. People have tiny apartments. They must get out of their apartments. But I wonder, is the city designed to accommodate people's need for quiet? How do you find quiet in a city like Paris in particular?
Well, I think go away from the main tourist sites. One thing I noticed when I'd written my book about Paris is that afterwards I looked at it and I thought, this doesn't look like Paris. It just looks like a city. And then I realised I hadn't put in any of the familiar tourist sites like the Eiffel Tower or the Louvre. In fact, I've never been to the Louvre, and I've never been to Palais de Tokyo, the really big art centres. So I think go away from the tourist sites and just wander along the back streets. I found really nice artist studios and little shops selling jewellery. If you just avoid the kind of places where the crowds go, then you can discover quietness.
Now, when you think of the cafe culture in Paris, that's a big part of Paris. Do you find some of them are designed to be noisy and full of commotion, and others are make a point to protect the quiet?
I suppose the larger brasseries will be quite noisy, but I found quiet cafes, and especially cafes in art centres. And there's one called Le Bal, which is in the north of the city, near Place de Clichy, and that was really nice, and they do homemade cakes and wonderful breakfast. So you can find culture as well as really good food in Paris.
What about the parks? It seems like when you have an intense city, the parks are just vital.
They are. The only problem is that I think on a sunny day, everybody will go out into the park. And especially in Amsterdam, well, and in Paris, because it's so grey and rainy in winter, if there's sunshine, everybody will just suddenly go outdoors. Whereas you don't get that so much in places like Spain or Morocco, because it's sunny most of the time.
It's not a big deal. Okay, but the quay of the Seine, the embankments of the Seine River, that's a nice little escape. The Promenade Planty. Describe the Promenade Planty.
Well, it's a converted railway line, and it's elevated above the street. So you can wander along, and it's been planted with beautiful trees, silver birches, and I think there's a beautiful pond, a very elegant rectangular pond with fish, and this is high above the street. So you do get some traffic noise, but it's still restful up there because you can't see the cars. You can just hear them. And lots of people walk along there. I thought it was really beautiful. Really good idea.
It's very lush. It's a long, skinny garden built on an elevated train line.
And there are also really nice hidden places in Paris. In the Jardin des Plantes, there's somewhere called the Jardin Alpin, which is the Alpine garden, and that's sort of hidden. You have to go under a little bridge to find that.
I love that.
And that's what I wanted to include in the book, places where you wouldn't find them if you didn't know the city really well. So I wanted to introduce people to hidden places as well.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Siobhan Wall about quiet places. Her guidebook series is Quiet Paris, guidebooks on London, Amsterdam, and New York. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Neil is calling in from Bayside in Wisconsin. Neil, thanks for your call.
Hello. I think in Paris in particular, you don't have to stray all that far from the tourist sites to find some peace and quiet. I found that the passages of Paris, those kind of enclosed, old, almost shopping malls, can be very quiet and not a lot of people, and perhaps a place to sit and have a glass of wine. There's one not far from the Louvre. There are several of them around town, and you can sit and enjoy the architecture, enjoy a little peace, and perhaps something to eat and drink as well.
You know, Neil, it's nice to be able to sort of just decompress after a very powerful sightseeing experience and sit down and think about what you saw and take a moment just to enjoy where you are.
And I really, I would like to place a vote for noise and excitement. And I think there's not much better than being in the West End of London when the theaters let out, or running down into the metro in Paris to head off to your next destination. That, for me, is a great deal of the fun, and I enjoy that a lot. But there are times where you want to, want to take a rest, find a little quiet spot, and you can find them almost anywhere. I think, walking by the Palais Royal, I think the first couple times I walked by, I never ducked into the gardens and courtyards in the middle. I think it looked a little private to me, and so I skipped it. And then one time ducked in and found this very kind of protected environment with fountains and benches and trees and sculptures, and at the same time surrounded by little shops and even great restaurants. So there are places that are near to the traditional tourist sites, but still provide those oases of calm.
Right, that Palais Royal, that brings back beautiful memories for me. I mean, yeah, it does feel private. In fact, it was originally, I would imagine, just for blue bloods. And of course, now they've cut off the head of the king and the queen a couple hundred years ago, so it's all ours. What about when you're at the Louvre? Where do you go for a little break near the Louvre? Because, I mean, the Palais Royal is fairly close to the Louvre, but right around the Louvre, it's a big grounds.
It is, and I think there is all of the commotion around the pyramid, whether it's the long lines of people trying to get in or just people seeing the exterior for the first time. But there is that courtyard, but then there is another courtyard just through an archway from the pyramid, which is surrounded on all four sides by the Louvre, and I think it's called the Cour Carrée. It just is, even during daytime, it's a very peaceful spot, and I know as evening falls, it gets very quiet. The architecture of the Louvre is beautifully lit, and it can be just a terrific quiet spot to spend a little time and enjoy your own private palace of the Louvre.
And I think that's the original courtyard, or the historic core of the Louvre, which has grown over the different reigns of different kings and so on. And it does feel like the pyramid has sucked all the people and the energy into that area. And then you just go to the older courtyard adjacent and you've got that little bit of tranquility. Neil, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
John's calling in from Annandale in Virginia. John, thanks for your call.
Hi, Rick. Good to talk to you. It's so critical to find those peaceful places in cities like Paris. And I'm blessed because I have a job that takes me there about every 2 months. Huh. And there's a couple places I've found there that are a little bit off the tourist zone, and a great place to relax where you can get away from kind of the intensity that can be Paris, particularly if you're working there. And one's on the east side of town. It's the Bois de Vincennes, and I apologize to anyone who speaks French for my pronunciation. That's where the Parc Floral that she mentioned is, but there's so much more there. There's these wonderful trails that you can walk and even rent bikes on. And a 14th century chateau, if for those of history buffs, that's had a number of people there, including the Marquis de Sade. So you can find history and a natural environment. It's also the site of where the zoo is now reopened and refurbished, and that's on the east side of Paris. And then over on the west, There's the Parc de Saint-Cloud, which is one of my favorite places. It's near where I work, and it's very accessible from the metro. Just take the 10 line. And there's this fabulous view over Paris at something called La Lanterne. And it's a view from the west side. You can see the Eiffel Tower and all the tourist sites. But when the sun's setting behind you, it just absolutely casts a glow on the city. Mm. And you can be there in a city of millions and have maybe three or four people around you. Mm. And it's just so relaxing and peaceful.
Siobhan, John's got some great ideas about parks.
Yes, and I really like the tiny parks that you find in Le Marais. Beautiful community gardens, which are exquisitely kind of full of box trees and lavender, and they're really exquisite places to sit and have a lunch together or just sit and talk to your friends.
Even popular as it is, the Place des Vosges, to me, is just a great little escape.
Yeah.
All right. John, thanks for your comments. Those are great ideas.
Thank you. Thank you both.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Siobhan Wall, and Siobhan's written a series of books helping people find quiet. Her books are called Quiet New York, Quiet London, Quiet Paris, and Quiet Amsterdam. Siobhan, let's just close our talk about quiet, and specifically quiet in Paris. If you're in Paris, in the center of Paris, and you've had a beautiful day of sightseeing and all the hubbub and the culture and the shopping and the food, and you want a quiet place just to be alone with your lover, where would you go? A romantic spot.
I'd probably walk down by the Seine. I think it's really calm and peaceful. And because there aren't many bars along some parts of the Seine, you find not many people down there in the early evening. I can remember taking photographs of an art shop called Sennelier. It overlooks the Seine. And I was getting a bus up north to Place de Clichy. And it was so deserted, but it was beautiful. The sunset was just coming down. It was really, really pretty.
You can take a picnic down there with your partner if you like.
Yeah, that would be nice. I think, actually, the mayor of Paris encouraged people to use it as a beach. He put sand down in the summer, and that might get a bit crowded, though.
Yeah, there's a lot of riverbank on the Seine, and there's plenty of nice spots to go. And at the end of the day with the sunset, with a good travel partner, that sounds very nice. Siobhan Wall, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for helping us find quiet in these great cities.
That was a pleasure.
Juste quelqu'un de bien, le cœur à portée de main. Juste quelqu'un de bien, sans grand destin, une amie à qui l'on tient. Juste quelqu'un de bien.
Threats to nature that weren't even discussed 50 years ago are making us take a closer look at how we protect the wilderness and its inhabitants. Up next, naturalist Gary Ferguson explores what's been accomplished in the 50 years since the Wilderness Act was enacted and the challenges wild places in America are facing today. It's Travel with Rick Steves. One great way to connect with the locals is to speak the language, or at least some of it. Rosetta Stone is a fast, fun way to learn. It's got helpful tools like online video chats with native-speaking teachers. You can take the Rosetta Stone demo or purchase the program at a special discount at rosettastone.com/ricksteves. Back in the 1960s, Americans were starting to recognize the need to do something to stem the damage caused by pesticides like DDT and toxic mining and forestry practices that were harming the natural world. When President Johnson signed the Wilderness Act in 1964, it had nearly unanimous support from Congress. Today, 109 million acres of federal lands are overseen by the National Park Service, the U.S. Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Bureau of Land Management. But as naturalist Gary Ferguson suggests, new threats, threats that weren't even discussed 50 years ago, require taking a closer look at how we manage and protect our wilderness, and how we take care of the creatures who call it home. Gary, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here, Rick. Thank you.
Now, if I understand the Wilderness Act, that was done back in Lyndon Johnson times, and it protected 9 million acres of federal land, and today that same protection zone has increased tenfold. It's over 100 million acres. At the same time, there are threats to wild places that weren't even considered 50 years ago. What does this all mean? What should we be aware of as we kind of celebrate 50 years of the Wilderness Act?
Well, the Wilderness Act is very much worth celebrating, in my opinion. It was and is to this day the highest level of protection ever afforded landscape. It was a nod to the notion that there are places that really deserve to exist just because they should have the right to exist, aside from whatever monetary value they might have or whatever other even recreational values they might have to human beings. So it was a landmark time back in 1964. You mentioned all the things that were going on back then with toxic chemicals. There was, I think at that point, about 1 billion pounds of DDT had been spread across the country. 600 people had died between 55 and 1966 in three separate smog events in New York City. In 69, there would be the biggest environmental disaster to date in the way of an oil spill off the coast of Santa Barbara. So part of the Wilderness Act was a declaration of how important landscape was amidst all this difficulty, this toxic time that we had had starting in the late 40s through the early 60s. But I think there's something else going on with the Wilderness Act, too, and that's that landscape has been, I would argue, the single most important factor in cultivating the way America has defined itself, especially in the first 150 years of this country's existence. We were very patriotic about the natural world. In the early 1750s, 1760s, the wild places were called the Great Equalizer, because they handed out their blessings and their risks equally. And of course, as you can imagine, then when we became a country, we turned to nature for symbols of equality and democracy. We had a national tree for a number of years. On and on and on it went. And so the Wilderness Act was also an act of considerable patriotism, as is the protection of those lands to this day.
And it's remarkable that it almost got unanimous support in Congress. I mean, I can see tree huggers saying amen, but when nearly every person in Congress votes yes, that's quite a statement.
It was remarkable.
50 years later, it's not seen that way. And some would say this is a waste of resources. Frame this as if you're talking to a skeptic. Give me a concrete, hard example of why protecting all this land really has a tangible value to Americans.
Yes, well, let's start with some pragmatic reasons. One out of every five American gets his or her drinking water from wilderness watersheds, 20% of the population in this country. That's a very good reason to protect those particular slices of wilderness. The carbon sequestration value, in other words, the ability of the forest to hold carbon, wilderness is a part of that system, which is, if you have to assign an economic value, it's been routinely estimated at being worth over $18 billion. So those are some very specific reasons. Another reason I would say is that in order for scientists to understand the effects of climate change on the system as a whole, and it doesn't matter if we're talking about an urban system or where we're talking about on the planet, they're turning increasingly to big, untrammeled, wild areas to use those as baselines, basically, so that you could hold up the changes you see in any particular ecosystem against the wild ecosystem and therefore really get a stronger sense of what's going on and therefore develop plans to mitigate the worst of the effects of climate change. So just from that research standpoint alone, wilderness areas are more important than they've ever been.
Wow. So, I mean, water is going to be a bigger deal in the future. The whole carbon and global warming thing is going to be a bigger deal. We need to be able to smartly measure where we're going with a baseline. And those are just the things that can be sort of monetized. And of course, we're in a culture where things need to be monetized. But you could make a case that the intangibles, and just for our soul and our spirit, are far beyond that, to have a place where we can just go and be with nature.
Well, I think that's true. And I've been for years struck by something, of all people, Sigmund Freud said. And Sigmund Freud was no nature boy, I assure you. But back in the 20s, he made an interesting comment that the wild preserves, and he was talking about America's wild preserves, serve the same function in a culture that fantasy serves for individuals, and that if we get rid of either one, neurosis would follow. And he was talking about the fact that wilderness, even if you don't go there, served as a kind of canvas for the culture to project their fears as well as their hopes and aspirations and sensibilities toward beauty and mystery and enchantment. And so he saw these wild places as remarkably important for the imaginative capacity of the culture. And I think we do live at a time where imagination has never been more necessary to meet some of the challenges like climate change and the other things we're trying to figure out as we go along into this new millennium.
That is a powerful testimony from somebody you might not expect. So it sounds like 50 years ago, everybody agreed the Wilderness Act was brilliant, really important. 50 years later, we can make the case it's even more important than ever as we're confronted by some pretty serious environmental challenges. We're talking with Gary Ferguson. Gary's book is The Carry Home, Lessons from the American Wilderness. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Laura is calling in from a beautiful place from a nature point of view, Boulder in Colorado. Laura, thanks for your call.
Hi, thanks, Rick. I guess my question goes to the idea of furthering the imagination of the American people. I was a Girl Scout for 13 years in Texas, and over time, the members of our troop unfortunately became pretty disenchanted with what we had access to, and instead of spending our troop money to go camping, we would go to hotels and to shows, and so I liken like our experience to someone maybe living in a food desert, people who don't have access to inspiring places and kind of lose touch and become more separated with their environment. And I see it as a problem for protecting the wilderness because we need people to have a relationship and for the wild not to really feel like a foreign country. And so when I came out to Boulder, I definitely had that feeling of like one versus the other, where I didn't know how to interact with nature or what to wear or what it should sound like and things like that. And so I guess my question is really more, how can we cultivate the relationship between Americans and their land so that more people will care about protecting it?
Wonderful, wonderful questions. I'm struck by, as you are, by how disconnected a lot of us are anymore from the natural world. I talk often about something that ancient storytellers insisted was essential for living well in the world, and those are qualities of beauty, community, and mystery. And no matter where we get those in our lives, nature is a sure fireplace to get them. And they also talked in those ancient times about the consequences of not having them in our lives. And I think that's what we face right now. You know, I think that we need to put a lot of emphasis into getting kids when they're young out into green spaces, community gardens. That's the other thing. Wilderness is wonderful. But I would argue that those notions of community, beauty, and mystery can also be cultivated in the smallest plot of land in the inner city, perhaps not quite as easily as the wilderness would provide. But we do need to make experiences for kids in nature a priority. There's, of course, the movement that Richard Louv launched about Last Child in the Woods that is seeking to do just that. And so to the extent that we can all support those efforts, so much the better. The one other thing I'd like to say, though, is that the baby boomers who were kids when the Wilderness Act was passed and would become fantastic, if somewhat brilliantly naive, advocates for the planet in the late 60s and 70s, and much of the reason we have the planet we have is because of that effort, have sort of disconnected as well from the priority of nature being a priority. I've wondered sometimes if the culture, at least that part of the culture, needs to lay claim to its elderhood status, which, like it or not, it's entering right now. And one of the ways I'm imagining that might happen is for the baby boomers to simply look at some of the mistakes that we made in the past, some of the ways we've ignored things that were happening right under our noses. And that's not necessarily meant to be a bummer that we're taking on some great weight of shame and guilt. It's simply turning our face to acknowledge and to reconcile the things we haven't done well so that we can get to the other side of that and begin living with a little bit more responsibility and more inspiration and more commitment to the younger generation.
I think it's a responsibility to the future, to future generations, that we do exactly that. Laura, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Our guest, Gary Ferguson, is a respected naturalist. Gary's authored nearly two dozen books on nature, science, and culture based on a lifetime exploring the rugged trails and rivers of America. He's part of the National Geographic Lecture Series, and you'll find information about Gary at wildwords.net. His latest book is a very personal tale about how human nature and the wilderness converge, following the death of his wife in a canoeing accident in northern Ontario. It's called The Carry Home, Lessons from the American Wilderness. It's published by Counterpoint Press. Gary, just to wrap things up, 50 years after the Wilderness Act, what's the state of the conservation movement today in our country? What are you most thankful for, and what are you most frustrated by or concerned with?
Well, I think the conservation movement is doing a good job of focusing on local issues and empowering people to take care of their own backyard, as opposed to times when different groups have tried to direct things from national centers on the East or West Coast. It always makes sense to fund people and to empower people to take care of their backyard, as I said. The other thing that I'm very encouraged by is the amount of effort that young people are putting into everything from the farm to table movements to sustainability on many levels. I also am very heartened in the area where I spend much of the year in Greater Yellowstone by the kind of efforts that are going on to secure animal migration routes. One of the things that is happening in the face of climate change, more severe than any other, is that different species are going to become regionally extinct because they're losing habitat. And in upland ecosystems, that habitat simply is higher up on the mountain or further north, if you will. And so to secure the chance for these species to migrate to more appropriate habitats as the climate changes is going to be a fundamental aspect of saving these creatures in the years to come. So all of that makes me pretty hopeful.
Gary, thank you for your passion for nature and sharing it through your teaching and your writing. Last image. You've got a chance to take a child from a big city, an urban center that's never had the ability to get out there and connect with nature. You've got one day to get them out into the place that stokes your passion for nature, to turn them into the nature lover that perhaps they were meant to be but never had the opportunity to learn that. Where would you take them and what would they experience?
Well, I would take them to the Lamar Valley of Yellowstone National Park in the month of May, when there are approximately 1,500 bison having calves, and to watch those calves stand up and shake themselves off and begin to totter off through the meadows, where wolves are wandering up and down, where grizzly bears show up to look for carcasses and feed themselves. That particular valley is among the most wildlife-rich ecosystems in the temperate world. And there is nothing that needs to be said. I've seen children for 25 years now stand there and watch these sort of marvels unfold. And I think without saying anything, without explaining anything, I've seen it happen across 25 years that I've been in the Lamar Valley. A child simply gets what a significant and beautiful and enchanted world he or she is a part of. And that's something that they can take with them for the rest of their lives and often do.
Wow. So two things. Make sure children get this opportunity and make sure there is the wilderness for them to enjoy that opportunity. Gary Ferguson, yes. The Carry Home, Lessons from the American Wilderness. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Rick. Thank you.
Dennis Hayes grew up in a small paper mill town on the Columbia River. On a clear day, he could see three snow-capped mountains as well as mile-wide clear cuts in the local forests. The very waters that Lewis and Clark fished in now had incidents where thousands of fish were killed off by effluent from the mill. The smell of prosperity, as the locals called it, was actually laced with sulfur dioxide and hydrogen sulfide. While the pulp mill provided an income for his father and most of his neighbors in Camas, Washington, Dennis knew from an early age that the land needed laws to protect the environment if there was to be anything for future generations to enjoy. Dennis became the national coordinator of the first Earth Day in 1970 and turned it into an international observance 20 years later. As president of the nonprofit Bullet Foundation in Seattle, Dennis Hayes joins us now for a look back on how his own hometown stimulated his work in bringing Earth Day to the rest of the world.
Hundreds of millions of people in more than 160 nations pause each year on April 22nd to take some action for Earth Day. It's a time to reflect on the only planet in the entire universe that we know is capable of supporting human life. Hi, I'm Dennis Hayes. Earth Day began in 1970 in the United States. As its first national coordinator, I'd say that it's made three valuable contributions. First, it created a big tent for everyone who shared environmental values. Long before Earth Day, Rachel Carson had poignantly described the ecological collapses caused by agricultural poisons, and John Muir had extolled the vibrant grandeur of untrammeled wilderness. Activists in vibrant inner-city communities were already protesting plans to plow 8-lane freeways through their living room, and parents were terrified to learn that children breathing the polluted air of Los Angeles were inhaling the equivalent of 2 packs of cigarettes a day. But none of these interest groups, or hundreds of others, realized that they had anything in common with one another. Earth Day wove them all into something stronger than the sum of the parts, the shared fabric of modern environmentalism. Second, Earth Day established that economic growth was not the only thing of importance to the American public. The gross domestic product does not measure the quality of our lives, the robustness of our health, the creativity of our artists, or the love that we have for one another and for all of creation. Audited financial statements contain no entries for the Bill of Rights or for biodiversity. Third, Earth Day was about solutions. Humans had made all these problems, and humans could unmake them. In the 3 years following that first Earth Day, we pushed through the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and the Occupational Health and Safety Act. We also created the Environmental Protection Agency. Even though I was just 25 years old at the time, I was recruited by Senator Gaylord Nelson to be the national coordinator of the campaign. My first sense of the true magnitude of the new force we were unleashing came in New York City. I waited on a 70-foot-high stage to address a crowd that packed the entire Great Lawn of Central Park. In fact, it even spilled down 6th Avenue, farther than the eye could see. The official police estimate of the crowd size at just that one Manhattan location was more than 1 million people. With 20 million participants nationwide, Earth Day was the largest organized demonstration in American history. But why? Throughout nature, the most powerful drive of living things is for survival, and the power of Earth Day lay in its ability to tap that core instinct. For the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, which we're approaching in the year 2020, we need to find ways to tap into that survival instinct once again. Just imagine what we can do if we can work together to address the new global threats that we all have to confront.
Dennis Hayes is president of the Bullitt Foundation in Seattle. His website has information about the book Dennis and his wife have written. It's called Cowed: The Hidden Impact of 93 Million Cows on America's Health, Economy, Politics, Culture, and Environment. It's at DennisHayes.com. That's spelled D-E-N-I-S.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe Through the Back Door in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton with Sarah McCormick and Isaac Kaplan-Wolner. Thanks to Desmet Studios in Amsterdam and to OPB Portland for their help this week. You'll find guest information, program extras, and you can listen again on demand each week in the radio section of ricksteves.com.
Support for Travel with Rick Steves comes from Rosetta Stone, helping you learn a new language on your smartphone. Rosetta Stone uses images and games to teach instead of rote memorization. Learn more at rosettastone.com/ricksteves.
Each year, Rick Steves tour guides take free-spirited travelers on escorted tours all over Europe, one small group at a time. This year, you can choose from 36 exciting itineraries covering the best of Europe from Ireland to Istanbul, Paris to St. Petersburg, and practically everywhere in between. For a free catalog and Rick's Tour Experience DVD, visit the tour pages at ricksteves.com.